Robert Kelly, let's talk a little about this show, Christmas Memory. There have been other shows that you've done that could have life well beyond theater works. I'm thinking specifically of Everything's Ducky, which was the Henry Krieger show, as well as Memphis, which wound up on Broadway. At what point did they approach you? Did you approach them?
A lot of these shows came about in different ways. Most of the shows we've had that we've launched around the country or that have made it into New York have come through our New Works Initiative, which is a decade old now. Everything's Ducky was right at the beginning of the New Works Initiative. It came about because of a production of Sideshow that we did shortly after it closed on Broadway. We picked it up here, and the authors were very eager to see what kind of life it might have. It hadn't lasted anywhere near as long as they had hoped on Broadway. They came to TheaterWorks to see the second production in the country and were very, very excited by what they saw, and that led them to approach us about the next show they had, which was Everything's Ducky.
Sideshow didn't work on Broadway, and I always wondered why.
Well, it was an unusual subject matter. I think even our audience, which is very supportive of new work, found it pretty unusual, but it had such a drive to it and such fascinating women at its core that it really did catch on here. I think the kind of ugly side of freak shows was what they were called back in the 20s and 30s when the famous sisters, conjoined twins, were active, has a negative connotation nowadays that it didn't really have then, and the two women had become big stars. And finding the underlying hope and also despair in their lives really proved to be a wonderful dramatic musical. Memphis was a whole nother story that came about through our New Works Initiative and our New Works Festival. It actually came into our first New Works Festival, and I got to direct it. And they were just getting started. They had a version of it that they wanted to try out. We gave it a very good reading that let the authors see what they had, really, Joe DiPietro and David Bryan. And after that, they were eager for a production, and off we went. We premiered it here. Unfortunately, it sort of sat around for 4 years as a producer who had the rights to it, failed to put it on anywhere, just sort of sat on it for a while. And once the option was gone, bingo, it got produced and made its way to Broadway, with a lot of the stars from our original show still there. So we were thrilled.
And now it's been running for a year, I guess.
Yes, and it's running strong. Won the Tony Award. It was a real thrill. I mean, it wasn't actually a surprise that it did well on Broadway from our perspective, because it had been, I think, our biggest hit of all time when it opened here. And that was a brand new work that no one had ever seen. You know, you expect it'll take a while to catch on. And it caught on overnight. I mean, instantly, the tickets were flying out the door.
This new show, A Christmas Memory, which is based on, well, first a short story by Capote, then it was adapted by Capote for television, and then Duane Poole adapted it again for television. He approached Grossman and Hall, and they got together, and this was before you were involved, correct?
Yes, yes. We got on board through a producer named Jason Raitt, who had been to our New Works Festival several times, had seen the work we do here, and felt we were a good match for the show. That led to a meeting with Larry and Carol in New York. They demonstrated some of the songs for us. I was instantly interested. It really felt like the kind of thing that would be good for our audience and really good for the holiday season. And it was new and exciting, and I love Capote's work, so this was really a chance to make something new and celebrate the season at the same time.
Were you involved at all in the March workshop at Human Race Theater?
No, I didn't go to it. Our new works director, Meredith McDonough, went and was able to get a set of notes for what would be the next workshop, which was just a couple of months later at TheaterWorks. At Human Race, they got a little time to work together, which was really invaluable for this team because they live on opposite coasts. Duane lives in L.A. and Larry and Carol in New York. So just finding time when they could actually be in the same place at the same time was helpful, and that led to a one-week staged reading workshop here at TheaterWorks in May, and another one then in September. And each time the show made a big jump forward, and a lot of changes got made, and new things went in, some things went out in the process. By the time we got to September, most of the cast was intact at that point. We then added one more person to the cast for this version here.
Which is the adult buddy.
Adult buddy, yeah. Joshua Park, and he's just fantastic, doing a great job.
Kelly, let's talk a little about this process and how we get to here, because I'm always fascinated by how an artistic work develops. Carol Hall told me, she happened to be sitting next to me at the theater on opening night, she told me that the original show in, I guess, March or May, the sister character who eventually sends Capote off to military school was the villain. Yet by the time I saw it, it was not. And she said that that was a real problem in terms of the show. Why do you think that was?
The character was not terribly well developed in the original version. She just was the person who was the uptight one and insisted on young Buddy being sent away to school. But why wasn't very clear. And in many ways, she represents a kind of a way of thinking that was pretty prevalent at the time, certainly in the South, and remains in place today, that you need to shape people up, you need to man up young kids and all of that. It's kind of, let's face it, pretty old-fashioned school of thought, but that's the way it was, and that's what happened to Capote, actually. You know, he was, in fact, sent to military school and a bunch of them, different schools over the years. But seeing that people who made such decisions were real and they had a real point of view, they had a reason to think the things they did, became increasingly important to all of us, me as the director and the writers themselves. So the character was fleshed out so that we'd understand a little more about what her thinking was and why she felt this was important. In the end, I think we're able to have a villain in a way, because you really don't want to see the two leads, the two protagonists, split up, and yet you come to understand why someone would feel that was worth doing and why it was important.
When you're talking about fleshing out, what exactly did you do? Did that big song she sings toward the end, was that when that was added?
It was already there by May, but it was a much smaller, shorter song, and it didn't really talk about her as much as it talked about Buddy, about a boy and what a boy needs. The premise is a boy needs a man to go fishing with, etc. But we didn't actually ever know why this woman was supporting this essentially cliched view of how you raise a young boy. At that point, we gave it some thought and added the rest of the song, which is sort of doubled in length and much more deep into her psychology, and that came in September. And it does sort of change the dynamic of the play. The person you think is really awful turns out to be making a choice that, in a way, you can at least understand, even if not it's not the choice you wish were made.
I saw the workshop in September. Even from then till now, she got toned down.
Well, I think she did, and we talked about it a lot to try to find out what kind of person this was supposed to be. She's a woman who takes care of both of her siblings and is the breadwinner for this family of three unmarried senior citizens, and she's been taking care of them from the days of their youth. It's a very interesting dynamic, and that's actually was the case with how Capote was raised. A significant part of his childhood was spent with exactly these people.
Is Sook supposed to be younger than her sister?
It's not totally clear. We've played the younger sister as the one who's in charge. Now, there's not a lot of information about that. They have come out of biographies rather than out of Capote's writings, per se. Sook, of course, is part of at least three stories, and he has a very vivid memory of her.
The real Truman Capote's physical life, if you want to say, was very specific. If you've seen Capote or Infamous, you kind of get an idea. It seemed that you decided not to go that route here.
Well, he's called a sissy by one of the characters in the play, but we're not playing him that way particularly. He's a young boy who is not physically powerful. He talks about being easily beaten up by the girl next door, who's his great friend all the same. But you always choose what details you're going to show of someone's life, and mostly what we show is him spending a life with this very rather eccentric cousin who's much, much older, in her 60s, doing things that are not your typical boy, guy kind of things, you know, cooking fruitcakes and picking flowers and doing a lot of things. It's not a gun-toting southern boy going out on a hunting trip at age 8.
But the older Buddy has none of those characteristics.
He's a character that we don't get into a lot of details of his life. You know, you ultimately have to make choices in a show like this, and the choice is to show the writer side of him without getting into all of the details of his life. And what you see is a writer whose dilemma of trying to figure out what he's going to actually write about after a successful first novel seemed to be the right way to go, because what we really have of Capote in this case is what he put on the page, you know. And in this case, focusing on the writer aspects of his older self became at least an interesting story for us to tell. He has to rediscover what it is that he's got to say, and he discovers that in his childhood and in his youth. That's actually what happened in terms of Capote's writing. A lot of his short stories from the 50s, especially the early 50s, deal with life in Monroeville when he was a young boy.
As I was comparing, trying to remember what I saw in September with what I saw now in December, it seemed that he moved away from the focus of will he go to military school to more a focus on his relationship with Sook. Am I wrong about that?
Well, I think it probably came into focus a little more. We added a song for Sook that really talked about how strongly she felt about him. And as a result, anything that Young Buddy says about her comes into focus as well. When he says, I don't care what happens to me, I just care what happens to Sook, it starts to accumulate. Some of the same lines that seemed sort of not terribly important in passing, I think, have gotten a lot more emphasis in this version, because ultimately the military school is what's going to happen in the future. But what's going to happen right now is this immensely close relationship that's everything a mother and son relationship might ever be, and probably perhaps more, is about to be pried apart. And that's the real gist of the play. That's what he's writing about.
Stephen Sondheim's book, Finishing the Hat, he discusses three elements that he thinks are absolutely essential to theater and to lyric writing and maybe to all art. And I'd like to mention them in terms of how a show like Christmas Memory comes about. One, less is more. Two, God is in the details. And the third, content dictates form. In terms of those three, let's start with content dictates form. How does that relate to a show like A Christmas Memory?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, the content is a memory of, selected memory of things that happened growing up. There really are very old memories that kind of at the point at which the brain of this young man was formed. And let's just say Capote's brain was formed. An emphasis on creativity, on storytelling, on the imagination. A lot of lessons that he's learning from an adult that's not part of the adult world, that is part of a world more focused on dreams and memories and more or less entirely positive thought and a sense of humor that he inherits. All those things are in a very short story that couldn't be more than 20 pages long, seem to be the inherent content. So what's the form to be? And in this case, I think Duane, who is really the one creating the basic format and form of the piece, wanted it to honor the book and the actual words of the book. Well, you can't very well have an 8-year-old mouthing the words of Capote. Capote has turned his experience into poetry. You know, it's prose, but really it reads like poetry. So I think that's where the narrator format really clicked in. And it's not so easily done in a musical. But it turned out that being able to go back and forth between the present, which was in 1955, and the past, which is in 1933, was very easily achieved. Duane has written it very beautifully with kind of a cinematic approach, very challenging for the director, but wonderful for the writer, that allows the play to bounce back and forth between those eras. And he added a character who exists in both eras, and just simply, with a change of a sweater and a pair of glasses, is suddenly 20 years older at any time you really want to access it in the play.
And at your end, that means, and I noticed you couldn't really tell in a workshop, it means involving the older Capote intimately with the younger ones, almost like a future ghost.
Very much so. He kind of climbs into his memory, if it were a film of stepping through the screen into the reality of that's being portrayed on the screen. The challenge, I think, for us and for Joshua, who plays the older version of Buddy and therefore of Capote, the challenge was to gradually make that connection. You know, he starts out with just seeing faces, actually, or just seeing a body of the various people. And then he starts remembering as he gets into his house the different aspects of the house and what would happen in it. And over the course of the play, you gradually see him getting closer and closer to young Buddy, to his younger self. Finally, in some of the later scenes, or some of the more focused and important moments, the two stand side by side and they seem to be identical. And in fact, they start saying the same thing at the same time. And there's one moment that really wasn't in the script book that we added where all three hands come together, an older buddy, the younger buddy, and Sook all at one. And that for me is kind of the climax of their relationship where they talk about, will you remember me always? And he says, always is what he says.
So in other words, by moving the focus away from the story of the military school, what happens instead is we see older buddy reconnect with Sook and younger buddy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, the military school is what's going to happen, and it certainly is a major part of the plot of what's going to, you know, of the story, because it is in fact what breaks up this wonderful friendship. But as the book does, we don't spend more than a line or two saying, and from then on, I was at military school, or, you know, prison-like summer camps and all kinds of things that where people send children they don't really care about very much.
The other two things Sondheim talked about, one is less is more. When you're taking a 20-page story and expanding it, at what point do you realize that less kicks in and becomes, you know, more important than more?
Well, it was, I think, a constant thought and a constant point of discussion among all of the creators of the piece as we worked on it. Inevitably, every time we did a workshop of it, there would be questions about, well, what happens to the rest of Buddy's life? Because you actually have Buddy 20 years later, he's standing there, and the question is, who does he know? What are his relationships? You know, and especially when you think of Capote, you could write about 200 musicals that would fit and fill in the 20 years. But I think Duane very wisely kept saying, that's not what this story is about. This story is about this memory of his early youth, and it's a vital one. It's just terribly important to him. I think the reason it's important is that what you see is his creativity coming to life. You see him start to invent things in the earliest song where he's making fruitcakes with Sook, but he's also turning it into a little bit of a show, having all kinds of fun with just everyday ordinary of cooking, baking fruitcakes and all of that. And you start seeing this very fertile and creative mind starting to happen and starting to form right before your eyes. For me as a director, that was always a question, was why this moment, why this particular December does he want to remember so strongly? And of course, it's the last Christmas with Sook. But from a point of view of what would happen in this man's life, it's the last chance for his inner creativity to really express itself on its own. That's really what I think it's about.
And the third one that Sondheim mentioned is God is in the details, which I guess kicks in because what happens is as you try to shape it, you have to give as much information in as little time as possible.
That's for sure. There's a lot going on. And there's a lot of little wonderful details in this show that don't absolutely have to be there, but they contribute each one in accumulating. I mean, the moment that I think about just as we're sitting here that I love immensely is a little scene in which Buddy brings a Christmas present to Nell Harper, who lives next door. And Nell was actually the nickname of Harper Lee, who did live next door to him and was the author of To Kill a Mockingbird. And in this little scene, he's grateful to her for a kind of pact they made over a scary incident in the play. And he obviously likes her and brings her a notebook and a pencil as this Christmas gift. From all the reading I've done and the biographies of both of these wonderful writers, you know that the two of them grew up together writing stories and exchanging stories. They even had typewriters at one point, and they typed stories together on the same typewriter. But here is where it all begins, and it's just a little tiny scene where you go, oh my God, he's giving her the gift of creativity. You know, it's just a hugely exciting moment for me.